wat kon nu waradu ste wat gwego tanya don has gigo then on ze wat ahun sadache un gwehu wen hadi wat nodus ne ne aboriginal voices oska te war nyawar oska ne jota fm cfrc
The Independent Wrestling Academy is back. On Saturday, May 17th, catch Stepping Up 2 live at the Spire on 82 Sydenham Street. This family-friendly, all-ages professional wrestling event is headlined by two title matches. Alexei Orlov defends his Academy Championship against Dino Benjamin, and the IWA Tag Team titles are on the line in the first ever Tag Team Eliminator Gauntlet. Tickets are available now at iwacanada.ca. $15 if you order in advance, $20 at the door. Doors open at 5 p.m. and bell time is 5:30.
Attention Queen's University community! Get ready to celebrate the achievements of mature women students at Queen's. The Ben Rhee Foundation is hosting its annual Spring Celebration. Join us in Grant Hall on Saturday, April 26th at 2 p.m. for this free event. Doors open at 1:30 p.m. Visit the Ben Rhee Center's website, follow the Ben Rhee Center on Facebook or Instagram, or email brc@queensu.ca for more information. See you there!
Hello, everyone. You're listening to Alchemy on 101.9 FM CFRC. It is 11 a.m. and we are in the lower level of Carruthers Hall in Kingston, Ontario. But the fun fact is it's not actually 11 a.m. when we're recording this.
No, it's
because we're coming to you from the past. We, as in me and a special guest. Would you like to reveal yourself?
I would love to. Hi, everyone. My name is Michael. Some people call me Mike Jones.
Mike Jones.
They don't call me Mike Jones, but...
No, that could be your radio persona.
Can it?
If you want it to.
Well, I think the name's already taken by some rapper.
That's okay.
Yeah. So I'm not the Mike Jones, but...
Not to be confused with a rapper, because Lord knows that we would confuse you with a rapper.
Yeah. I don't. Should I say something about myself?
Well, I can give a little intro to the episode. Honestly, I feel like you're the host today and I'm a guest on your show because we're doing something very personal to Michael that he introduced me to. A little vinyl cafe.
Yeah.
Story time situation.
Story time indeed. No, I love the Vinyl Cafe. It's a show that was introduced to me and my brothers and my sister by our parents. Yeah, the Vinyl Cafe, it's a radio show. It used to air on CBC, hosted by this guy named Stuart McLean. He's a really incredible storyteller. So for the Vinyl Cafe, he writes all these stories and then performed them on radio. And I guess he also did some live shows as well.
We love radio and we love live.
We do love radio. maybe I should say something about Stuart McLean. I guess
he
was born in Montreal. He had an early childhood, as one does. Yeah. And
I remember my early childhood. It was quite early.
And there's this story that our parents always told us.
that we are now unsure of. But we love folklore also. If there's one thing we love on radio, it is stories being passed down.
So true. So by way of storytelling, my parents let us know that apparently... The Stuart McLean guy, he wanted to work in radio. He just had a passion for it. But I guess he was on some hard times, was down on his luck. And he somewhere, I don't know why, I think this was around Christmas time or New Year's.
It seems fitting.
It seems fitting. Anyways, we'll get to it. But he was at a bar. He was spending his last $10 or $5 on a beer, as my parents like to say. And apparently he got on the piano at the bar, started singing some tunes, and then was noticed by a CBC producer who also happened to be in the bar at the time, and then was offered a job. The internet has not confirmed this story. It's a really cool story.
It is a cool story, and fate is a beautiful, beautiful woman who smiles down on those who she favors. So, I mean, if this is true, then we can just... I don't know.
Yeah.
Attribute it to fate.
And hey, my parents aren't liars, so.
No. And even if they are, they're very creative, and I love the story.
Yeah. So. Anyway, so that's how apparently how Stuart got his first start at CBC, and he eventually started running these things.
Lovely.
Yeah.
So today, the format of our episode is going to be a little different because we are dealing with short stories and not songs, but we have two for you today. They are around 20 minutes each, so you're going to hear a bit from us, mostly Michael, and he's going to introduce the story, any sort of things to look out for, and then we're going to play the story for you, pop back in, and then send you off on your merry way for your noon o'clock activities. All right?
Heck yeah.
Cool. So our first one is
Mary Turlington and Polly Anderson's Christmas Party. This story, there's a lot of really good Vinyl Cafe stories. My brother Andrew and I were like debating last night which ones we should put on today's show.
It was a very heated discussion.
It was indeed. but this one is a really funny story. It's chaotic, and I think it really showcases Stuart's like humorous side. Some of these stories we like kind of categorize as like more humorous or maybe more serious, more like kind of nostalgic. But this one's a really funny one. It kind of centers around a Christmas party and a miscommunication and a misunderstanding, but a really beautiful message at the end. So yeah, I really love this story. And I can't wait for you guys to hear it.
Amazing. So this is our first one. This is going to be Mary Turlington and Polly Anderson's Christmas Collision.
As everybody knows, Polly and Ted Anderson hold their annual Christmas party. They're at home on the second Saturday of every December. It is a tradition. The neighborhood event of the year. Everyone marks the Anderson's Christmas party in their calendar months in advance. Everyone keeps the second Saturday in December free. Even Mary Turlington. Especially Mary Turlington. Mary adores Polly's party. The fancy hors d'oeuvres, the exotic drinks, and that magical moment at the end of the night when Ted lights the candles on the branches of the Anderson's tree and everyone gathers in the hall to sing carols. Now, of course, Mary wishes that it was her husband, Bert, and not Polly's husband, Ted, lighting those candles. Mary wishes that she was the one who hosted the grand neighborhood party. Because if you want to throw a gold medal party, it is hard to top Christmas. There's just no other holiday that offers the grandeur of it, the thematic possibilities of decorations and music, costumes and food, presents and children. Christmas is kind of it, except for maybe a surprise party. Mary had always wanted a surprise party, but you can't throw a surprise party for yourself, although she had considered it. Believe me, Mary had considered all the options. The year her son Adam turned 12, for instance, Mary said to Bert, 13 next year. And Bert said, yep, before you know it, we'll have a teenager. Mary said, I'd be wondering about his bar mitzvah. Bert said, we're Presbyterian. And then one day, this fall, word got out that Polly wasn't going to throw her famous party this year. It was Gerda Lohbier who told Mary. Just an off-the-cuff remark. But the kind of off-the-cuff remark that has been known to start revolutions. Like most incendiary claims, it had a passing familiarity with truth. Polly had wondered aloud if people were tiring of her party. The Terriers didn't come last year, she said. Or the Schellenbergers. Like most perfectionists, Polly was suffering a crisis of confidence. All she needed was some reassurance, and she got that in droves. But not before Mary had heard the siren song of her abdication. Now, when a dancer hears music, she'll always find a floor to dance on. Especially if it's a tune she has been waiting to hear. When Mary heard Polly was vacillating, Mary jumped. With the best of intentions, mind you. Wouldn't be Christmas without a neighborhood party. And who better to step into the breach than her? And so it was, late in November, that everyone in the neighborhood received two invitations. One from the Turlingtons and one from the Andersons. Or more to the point, one from Mary and one from Polly. Both for the second Saturday in December. The gracious thing, of course, would have been for Mary to cancel, to phone everyone and explain her mistake, reel in her invitations, maybe replace them with a New Year's levee or an Easter brunch or a bar mitzvah. But the voice of grace whispered, Mary didn't hear it. In Mary's mind, everyone was already coming to her party, and that was the end of that. Mary had moved on. She had already chosen her signature color. It's so obvious, she said to Bert after weeks of fussing. I can't believe it took me so long. The best color is no color at all. Obviously, said Bert, who didn't have a clue what she was talking about. White, said Mary, a white Christmas. She would transform their house into a palace of white. The painters are coming tomorrow, she said to Bert. They're going to do the walls and the floors. Excellent, said Bert, thinking this wasn't excellent at all. She started working on the wreath the following weekend for the front door. It'll be the first thing up, she said, like a billboard on the edge of town. She worked on it for 3 days down in the basement. When she was finished, she called Bert and Adam to give her a hand. I need help, she said. They struggled up the stairs with that wreath as if they were carrying a sofa. It's a little bigger than your average wreath, said Bert, sweat pouring from his forehead. It was so oversized they couldn't fasten it to the front door. So they used pulleys and chains to suspend it from the door header. That should hold, said the consulting engineer. It was fine if all you were going to do was look at it from the sidewalk. But if you wanted to use the door, you had to crawl through the hole in the middle of the wreath. It's beautiful, said Bert, who knew which side his bread was buttered. As Mary homed in on party weekend with the intensity of a guided missile, the rest of the neighborhood watched its approach with growing anxiety. Lunchtime. The back booth of Kenny Wong's cafe. Carl Lobier, Bertie Schellenberger, Jim Schofield, and Dave, who had summoned them together. The neighborhood was heading for a collision, and someone had to do something. So the four of them ate lunch, and they talked about what that something might be. And of all the harebrained schemes they considered and could have settled on, of all the things, they settled on Dave's. They set up in the room over his store. They taped a large map of the neighborhood onto the ping pong table he has up there. By the beginning of December, there were enough colored pins sticking in that map and lists stuck to the walls that room looked like a military headquarters. We have the neighborhood divided into squads, said Dave. Each squad has a captain. Each captain has a schedule. It was the first captain's meeting. Dave and Dorothy and Carl, well, there were at least 12 of them around the table. The plan was simple. Both Mary and Polly would be told the other party had been canceled. But in fact, everyone in the neighborhood would attend both parties simultaneously. How How are we going to do that? Said Carl, captain of squad one. You each have four families, said Dave. In a minute, Jim is going to hand out your maps and schedules. At their assigned times, each captain was to slip their four families out the back door of whichever party they were at and rendezvous with the designated teenage drivers who would be standing by. The driver, said Dave, will ferry you back and forth. If everything went as planned, the squads would hop back and forth from one party to the other, and neither Mary nor Polly would be the wiser. Before you knew it, it was the second Saturday in December. 6 p.m. Look, there Bert and Mary, standing at their front door, in front of Mary's white wonderland. The walls and floors are painted palace white. The sofa and the chairs, the end tables and a dining room buffet are draped in white linen. There are platters of white canapes and pitchers of frosty beverages everywhere. Look at Bert, perspiring slightly in his white suit, his white leather shoes, his white top hat and gloves, and Mary in her set of white feathered angel wings. The two of them look as if they have been plucked off the top of a wedding cake. And there, a few blocks over and across the park, on the other side of the neighborhood, are Polly and Ted, standing under a candy cane arch at their front door. Polly is handing each guest a festive cocktail as they arrive. And look, there's Dave, standing in the room over his record store, staring at the map on the ping pong table with a black walkie-talkie dangling from his wrist. He's bringing the radio up to his mouth. Squad one, he says, this is Big Turkey. Go. Carl and his squad of families, 12 people in all, are the leadoff group. They go in Polly's front door, throw back their cocktails, and on Dave's command, slip out the back. They run down the alley like a pack of refugees. Heads ducked below the level of the back fence so they can't be seen. They're heading for the red garage at the end of the lane, where the drivers are waiting to speed them the seven blocks over to Mary's. A mere 15 minutes after they went in Polly's front door, Mary is greeting them at her front door with one of her festive white wine spritzers. Carl peers at his drink, shrugs, and throws it back. Before you know it, Dave's on the radio telling him it's time to head back again. Whoa, says Carl, as he staggers out the back door. Hang in there, says Dave. You're doing great. Out in the front yard, Bert is staring at Mary's wreath. It has been causing no end of trouble. I'm going to move it, says Bert. I'll put it back up in the morning. It took four of them to carry it. When they tilted it on its side to get it through the back gate, five-year-old Deirdre Llewellyn tumbled out into the snow. It's about time, said Deirdre with her hands on her hips. I've been stuck in there for over an hour. Carl Lobier and his squad were peering out from behind the garage as Bert and his team leaned the wreath against the back door. They were way too tipsy to navigate the wreath. So Carl pried open a basement window and began funneling them through it one by one. By the time everyone was inside, it was time to head back to the Andersons again. Of course, each time a group moved from one house to the other, glasses of cheer were thrust into their hands. And everyone was getting, what do I say? Exuberantly cheery. As Carl and his group tumbled out the back window, Gunnar Sjöstad staggered in the front door, scooped a plate of white asparagus from the dining room buffet, and pranced out again. "What are you doing?" said Mary as he danced by her. "No worries," said Gunnar. "I'll be back." One boisterous squad declined their drive and set off cross-country. When they were last seen, they were carrying a pitcher of Mary's white wine spritzers and a plate of white chocolate rum balls. They hadn't been heard of since. Down in Mary's basement, an abandoned walkie-talkie crackled to life. "Big Turkey to Squad 4. Over." Jim came on the radio instead. Jim said, "We've lost Squad 4, Big Turkey." Squad 3 set off to find them. Things were breaking down. The party had gone rogue. Faced with the growing difficulties of getting in and out of Mary's, everyone had settled at Polly's, and they were refusing to move, except for Gunnar, who had decided his contribution to the night was to get as many of Mary's snacks over to Polly's as possible. Mary had been tearing between the kitchen and the dining room all night. Each time she placed a fresh plate of appetizers on the buffet, there was Gunnar to take them away. Although there seemed to be fewer and fewer guests, she was running out of food. She couldn't figure it out. She knew something was going on. She opened the freezer. She pulled out the last plate of rum balls. As she set them on the counter, she thought she saw someone duck behind the garage. It had been happening all night. And it was at that moment, a floor below her, that Rick Moore sat up, burped, and looked blearily around. Rick was the leader of the missing Squad 4. He had come through the basement window an hour ago and promptly fallen asleep on the couch. Upstairs, Mary was arranging the rum balls on her last silver platter. She picked up the platter, moved it to one hand, smoothed her white skirt with the other, and then burst into the living room with a flourish, to find the living room completely empty, except for Rick, who had come upstairs and who blinked at her, grabbed her arm, and said with a slur, "Come on, we gotta get to the other place." As he hustled the bewildered Mary out the door, he pointed at the rum balls and said, "Bring the snacks and save Gunnar a trip." Five minutes later, they were standing in front of the Andersons' house. Mary couldn't believe it when Rick shoved her through the front door. Everyone was there. Finally, she understood what was going on, and she felt a surge of affection. After all these years, Bert had organized her a surprise party. Mary stood by the door staring at everyone and waiting for them to yell, "Surprise!" But instead, the room fell deathly silent. And that's when Polly flew out of the kitchen and the entire room swiveled as one. "Oh, good," said Polly when she saw Mary. Polly was the only one in the room who had no idea that something was amiss. "I was wondering when you'd get here. Did you get something to eat? There are the most extraordinary treats. Gunnar really outdid himself this year." In that briefest of moments, 1,000 expressions crossed Mary's face. Her shoulders tightened and then relaxed, which looked like her angel wings had begun to flap. And then she smiled and she said, "Thank you, Polly. You know I wouldn't miss one of your parties." Of course, she should have said that weeks ago. She should have said that when she realized she had been misinformed and Polly was still having her party. She should have stepped aside graciously. She was, as they say, a little late coming to the party. But they also say, better late than never. The room slowly filled with chatter again. And as it did, Mary whispered something in Dave's ear, and Dave slipped out the door and headed back to her house to collect Bert and the snacks that Gunnar had missed. It was maybe an hour, maybe two later, before Polly finally put it all together. Everyone else was still around and about, still chatting away, but the night was clearly winding down. Polly had begun clearing up, and Mary was helping her, carrying what was left of the white asparagus and the shortbread cookies into the kitchen. Polly had just picked up a plate of whitefish pate when she realized Mary was in a white dress and snowflake pantyhose. That's when the penny dropped. Polly had considered doing a white theme herself, and having considered it, she had no trouble recognizing it. They were alone in the kitchen now, the two of them. Polly had just put a platter high on a shelf over the fridge. She turned and looked at Mary and said, "Next year," and this was the closest they would ever come to actually talking about this year. "Next year," she said, "let's do the party together. Your food, my house." It was a small act of grace, of generosity, but it came from the depths of Polly's heart. Mary was about to say something, but before she could, Ted appeared through the swinging door and said, "It's time to light the tree. Where are the matches?" And Polly pointed at a drawer in the kitchen and said, "You always take so long to get them going. Where's Bert? Get Bert to help you." As Ted went looking for Bert, Polly put her arm around Mary's waist and steered her through the door. When the caroling began, the two of them were standing together beside the tree. The night traditionally ends with that boisterous old carol, "We Wish You a Merry Christmas." When they got to it, Polly leaned close to Mary and whispered, "I love this one." Soon, the entire room was dancing that dangerous line between singing and outright shouting. "Oh, bring us some figgy pudding. Oh, bring us some figgy pudding. Oh, bring us some figgy pudding and a cup of good cheer." The Christmas season is many things to many people. To some, it's the story of the birth of Jesus, the story of peace and love and the triumph of life over darkness. To others, it's a time of goodwill and fellowship, time to gather together with family and friends in schools, in homes, and in theaters. Some just like the decorations, the lights, and the warmth they give in this cold, dark time. Others just like the music. Even the little ones were singing along now, stomping their feet and waving their hands in the air. And Mary and Polly, too, singing along at the top of their lungs. The night's escapades completely forgotten. The two of them doing what women are so good at doing, moving on, living with a little victory and a little defeat. And if ever there need be proof of miracles, surely this would suffice. "Here we go," said Polly, resting her arm on Mary's shoulder. "Everyone now. We won't go until we get some. We won't go until we get some. We won't go until we get some. So bring it right here." Thank you, everybody.
Well, what an amazing little story.
Gooner.
I think he was my favorite character, I will say.
No, I do strive to be like Gooner. He's just trying to spread some good cheer.
Honestly, like, how many times have you entered a family function and just, like, beeline for the snacks, knowing that, like, that is your only motivation for being there?
Way too many to count.
Way too often.
Like, Baby Bells at a family function.
Is that a popular, like, family function treat?
Well, for us,
do they come wrapped or unwrapped?
They come, out of the plastic wrapper, but still in the wax.
I think that's a sensible...
Yeah.
But actually, like, at that point, why even take the plastic wrapper?
Well, the wax is kind of, like, tricky for one person. Like, I would get annoyed, so...
No, like...
Oh.
Why even bother taking the plastic off if you want it to be, like, a tactile experience for the viewer? These are larger questions that we're not going to answer on radio. I'm just leaving that for the audience to chew on. But that was such a good one. I really do love it.
No, I do like that story a lot. Like, as with all kind of, well, we call them Dave stories in our house because Dave. But, like, they're a bit of a slow burn. Like, but the if you stick with it, the jokes do come out.
Yeah.
And I like his little messages at the end of the story. There's always a little moral slipped in there.
I do love that. Yeah. It, like, reminds me of, like, when I would watch, like PBS Kids and like all of these like shows, like, yeah, they were like kids shows, but like they all like had some sort of like moral or like teaching at the end. But no, I really liked it.
Yeah,
it was
very good. No, this story is like a fantastic one to listen to around Christmas time. There's a bunch of like winter, like Christmas themed stories that for like that Stuart does. So no, they're always great to listen over winter break.
Lovely.
Such as Dave Cooks the Turkey. That's like probably the most famous Vinyl Cafe story.
Yeah.
So definitely go give that a listen.
This is like just like an intro to reading list for you guys now that you know these exist, / if you've been reintroduced to them. This is an invitation to get back into them because they are so fun.
They're awesome.
And it's like a welcome break from like not just listening to music or like being on your phone. Like I love like being introduced to a world that like your imagination is still involved because like it's not like you're watching a show where the story is being told.
No, exactly. You know? And like, yeah, just thinking about that during this story was like, this whole world gets built out as you listen to more stories and you get introduced to new characters and their personalities. So
have they ever like made visualizations of them, like animations or like
I'm not sure.
live action? I feel like that would be really cool.
It definitely would be. I will say though, like at the
or
same,
maybe that takes away some of the mystique.
Yeah, I don't know. Like I mean, just having listened to these stories, like I think I've developed my own
100%.
Images in my head and just like we always like make jokes and references to these stories. Yeah. And so I think that paints a picture in our heads, which is kind of, which is kind of also cool. If you are interested, you should totally listen to Defibrillator as well.
All right.
That is like my other like favorite funny story from Stuart McLean.
And I feel like even like, it's like, if you put two people in a room and like played this story out, like they'd be listening to the same thing, but the way they could imagine it in their head, like there are places where they could like differ, but like the ultimate kind of tale is the same, which is cool. Love it.
a gateway to introspection, as love. Some might say.
Yeah, you think so? We love that on radio, obviously. Okay, so we have one more story for you guys. Would you like to give a little rundown of this next one?
I would love to. So the next story we'll play for you is Boy Wanted. This is one of my favorite of all time Vinyl mm-hmm. Cafe stories. It introduces you to Sam. Sam is Dave's son. And I think it's his first job working at a grocery store. It's a fantastic representation of Stuart's storytelling ability. Like, yeah. You will probably drool throughout this, mm-hmm. this
I was,
story.
Like, listening to this one on my walk home. I haven't eaten since breakfast, and the way they, like, describe, like, what you're going to hear, different types of food and ingredients, it's very well done.
Yeah, it's a nice little coming-of-age story, so,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
All right. Up next is Boy Wanted from the Vinyl Cafe.
Took a long time. 3 months in all. And a lot of people would have given up. Most of them, probably. Well, fact is, most people wouldn't have started. Louis, for instance. Louis certainly wouldn't have started. It's crazy, said Louis. Why don't you just offer him the job? If you want him to work here so much, why don't you make him an offer? Because, said Mr. Harmon, that's not how things are done. And that is why every morning, just before the boy walked by the store on his way to school, Mr. Harmon slipped the sign into his grocery store window. Boy Wanted. As soon as the boy passed by, Mr. Harmon would take the sign down. He didn't want any other applications. Why would you want such a clueless boy, said Louis. He's not clueless, said Mr. Harmon. He's seen the sign. He's thinking about it. He's building his courage. Mr. Harmon, wise in the ways of boys, was wiser than most in the ways of this boy. But he couldn't be certain. So when the boy finally did come in, and he said, Mr. Harmon, I saw the sign in the window. I'd like to apply for the job. Mr. Harmon almost hugged him. But he didn't. Instead, he stood there beside the pomegranates, which he had been stacking into a pyramid, and he said, do you have a resume? Of course the boy had a resume. Typed. It was 5 pages long. It was Sam's first year in high school. And it was not going well. A minor niner. Looked down upon by all. He felt off balance, unsure and awkward. And if that wasn't enough, something was wrong with his voice. At the most inopportune moments, it would go crackly. And there were spots on his face, as if his body, which he had never even noticed before, had suddenly turned against him. Can you imagine, he said to his pal Murphy, what it would be like if on top of all this, I got my puberty? Mr. Harmon waited a week before he called Sam in for an interview. I will never understand you, said Louis. Never. He applied. What are you waiting for? Give him the job already. And so he did. And on the very first day, he put him in charge of fruit. And he told him he had to sweep the section. Had to take the garbage outside. He had to restock, getting stuff from Estelle in the back. And he had to keep an ear open for Louis on cash, calling for a carryout. Or if he saw there was a lineup, he was supposed to go and help bag. It sounded easy enough, but there was no training. And truth be told, it wasn't nearly as easy as it sounded. It wasn't easy at all. To make things worse, every time he turned around, there was Mr. Harmon, hovering, all eager to point out his mistakes. No, 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 said Mr. Harmon, nudging him aside as he bagged an order. You keep one hand in the bag so you can set everything down carefully. Mr. Harmon was pulling things out of the bag that Sam had already placed in there carefully. Those figs are going to get crushed, said Mr. Harmon. Put delicate things in their own little bags. It stops them from falling to the bottom. The worst, however, was when Louis went on break and he had to fill in on cash. Making change. Don't try to do the math in your head, said Mr. Harmon. Mr. Harmon was standing beside him, watching. How much was the bill? $16.36, Mr. Harmon. And he gave you a $20 bill, Mr. Harmon. Just count it up, said Mr. Harmon. You begin with the pennies. $16.36, right? Plus 1, 2, 3, 4 pennies makes 37, 38, 39, $16.40. Mr. Harmon smiled. Then add a dime, 16.50. Mr. Harmon was pulling coins out of the cash and handing them to Sam. Now, 2 quarters, $17. A loony, 18. And toony, 20. See, you don't have to do any math. Sam stared at him dumbly. You'll get it, said Mr. Harmon. But he didn't get it. Not at all. He felt as if he was a step behind. He felt like an imposter, clumsy and missing the point. Even alone in his section, he felt anxious. Watering, straightening, fluffing. Make it beautiful, Mr. Harmon had said on his first day. To make it beautiful meant to stand the carrots perfectly straight. To lay the romaine one beside the other. To wrap the apples and the oranges and the lemons in tissue and pile them in pyramids. Like in a picture book, said Mr. Harmon. I want my store to look like a picture book. On this day, he was working on avocados when Mr. Harmon appeared beside him. It was his third week, and he thought he was finally getting it. But no, 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 said Mr. Harmon. Not like that. Rotate the pile as you build it. Move the ripe ones to the top and the hard ones to the bottom. Mr. Harmon nudged him aside and started fussing with the fruit. No empty spaces. Every pyramid full, square, and straight. Mr. Harmon stood back and smiled at the avocados. He was proud of himself, but not only because of the avocados. Mr. Harmon was thinking that Sam was working out better than he had hoped. Sam, on the other hand, was thinking, this is my third week and I can't even stack fruit. Next morning, Sam was taking the garbage out when a group of his friends lurched past the store eating takeout. They didn't see him standing in the alley watching them bumping along. But Mr. Harmon did. And he saw the wistful look that crossed Sam's face. That day at lunch, Mr. Harmon wandered into his section and beckoned him. Sam followed him to the little kitchen at the back of the store. Mr. Harmon nodded at the milk crate opposite the stove. Sam sat down. Sam was thinking, oh boy. I'm about to get fired. But it wasn't his last supper. It was their first lunch. Every day from that day on, Mr. Harmon took Sam into the kitchen at the back, and Sam would watch Mr. Harmon cook. Well, listen more than watch, because while he cooked, Mr. Harmon talked. On this day, Mr. Harmon was standing there holding a black knife over a ripe tomato. When you cut a tomato, he was saying, you must always use a sharp knife. A dull knife might crush the flesh. Then he said, I used to be a barber. This is the way he talked. Seasoning his conversation with a sequence of delicious non sequiturs. Did you know that? Asked Mr. Harmon. I had a barber store in the connection. My own store. I had customers who came in every week. Fancy businessmen. Big tippers. He lay the blade of the knife against the skin of the tomato and looked up at Sam. I shaved them, cleaned up their necks. He pushed the knife forward and then pulled it back towards him. The tomato fell into two perfect halves, seeds and juice leaking onto the old wood cutting board. Mr. Harmon brought one half of the tomato to his nose, inhaled deeply, and smiled. Sam said, "What happened to the barber shop, Mr. Harmon?" Mr. Harmon was crinkling salt between his fingers. "Flaked salt," said Mr. Harmon. "It's from the sea. See how soft the flakes are?" Sam nodded, "But the barber shop, Mr. Harmon." Mr. Harmon said, "The Beatles came." Sam said, "They came to your barber shop?" Mr. Harmon shook his head. Mr. Harmon said, "Yes, they came and no one wanted haircuts anymore." Mr. Harmon picked up a second tomato. Sam said, "What did you do, Mr. Harmon?" Mr. Harmon said, "I closed the barber shop and got a job in a factory." He had four tomatoes cut in half now, and he poured a little olive oil on each one, some salt, some pepper, and then he put the tomatoes into the spattered stainless steel oven. 300 degrees, said Mr. Harmon. Sam looked at his watch. Mr. Harmon was down on his knees, staring in the oven. Mr. Harmon said, "After 3 hours, they'll look like shrunken heads. And they will taste like the essence of tomato." But Sam didn't hear that part. It was break time. Sam had gone to relieve Louis. Mr. Harmon didn't work in the factory for long. He worked in the factory until he couldn't stand it. And then he got a job in his cousin's grocery store. After 5 years, he bought the store. It was just a regular corner grocery when Mr. Harmon bought it. But slowly his love of food and his sense of order became apparent in the aisles. Slowly, the little store, like all little stores, became a reflection of his personality. What Sam liked the most was the perfection of the place. Walking into work was like walking into a cookbook. Everything was prepped in the back by Estelle, so everything out front looked perfect. There were cauliflower so pretty you could use them as centerpieces. There were regular beets and golden beets and striped beets and baby beets. There were heirloom carrots and 28 varieties of tomatoes. And pacing up and down the aisles in the middle of it all, like an orchestra conductor, there was Mr. Harmon. Under his tutelage, Sam finally found something he was good at. Facing the tomatoes. Meant organizing the cans of tomatoes perfectly, at the front of the shelf, labels facing out, no spaces. He loved all the primary colors of the labels, the bright yellow and red cans beside the bright green ones. San Marzano tomatoes from Italy. "The greatest tomato in the world," said Mr. Harmon. "You know why?" "The water," said Sam. "Yes," said Mr. Harmon. "And?" "The volcano," said Sam. "The ash." "That's right," said Mr. Harmon. "Tomatoes from Naples. Figs from Argentina. Grapes from Chile." Sam was learning geography in the best way possible, with his mouth and tummy instead of his brain. First time Mr. Harmon cooked pasta at lunch was the first time Sam ate it without meat sauce. Mr. Harmon served it with olive oil and garlic and lemon. "This is so good," said Sam, sopping up the olive oil with the bread. And oh, my stars, the bread. Crusty baguettes that tasted of fire. Black on the bottom, brown on top, soft and airy in the middle, the crust so hard it cut your mouth. "Tastes like burnt caramel," said Sam, "except sour." Because it's made from sourdough, said Mr. Harmon, reaching for the salt. He showed him how you could tell by the bottom if the bread had been made by fire or by factory. If it has tiny circles on the bottom, it means it rode a conveyor through a factory oven. He taught him how to dip the bread in olive oil instead of using butter, sprinkling some of the flaky salt on the oil first. Sam said, "You love salt, Mr. Harmon." Mr. Harmon smiled. Mr. Harmon said, "Flaked sea salt from England." After lunch, Sam went and stared at the shells of pasta. Pasta di semola di gran duro. Brown paper bags with cellophane windows. Cappellini, bucatini, spaghettini, linguine, and on the shelf of honor, all by itself, farfalle. Pastas shaped like bow ties, each one dyed with squid ink and beet water. Red and black striped bow ties, so perfect you could wear them. They made him laugh. Now he had a favorite job and a favorite section. One day Mr. Harmon said, "You've been here 3 months. You qualify for a professional discount. 20%. That night, Sam took home a bag of pasta and a box of sea salt. He was starting to feel like he belonged. Wasn't long after that that Mr. Harmon made him his first coffee, a cappuccino. Mr. Harmon made one for himself every morning. This morning, he put one down beside Sam. He had sprinkled sugar on the surface of the foamy milk so it crystallized. Drinking the coffee through the sugar foam, it didn't taste bitter at all. It tasted like the bread. Burnt caramel. "I like it, Mr. Harmon." It made him feel grown up. "You like this too," said Mr. Harmon. The two of them were sitting on their milk crates in the little kitchen at the back, a plate of greens covered with ribbons of salty Parmesan on their laps. Mr. Harmon was holding a bottle over the cheese. "Balsamic," said Mr. Harmon. "From Umbria," said Sam. 18 years old, thick like syrup. Mr. Harmon smiled. "And," said Mr. Harmon, "you can pour it on your vegetables," said Sam. "Drizzle," said Mr. Harmon. "You can drizzle it on your vegetables." One afternoon, Mr. Harmon said, "I'm going to the doctor tomorrow." He was holding out a key. "I want you to open," he said. There are moments in every life when things change forever. When boy meets girl, or girl meets boy, and there's a rustle somewhere far away, the sound of a page turning, the cards being shuffled, or a great flock of birds fluttering into the sky. A coming together. Or maybe it's a coming apart. Maybe it's a sad thing, not a hello thing at all, but a goodbye. And the birds don't flutter, they wheel into the sky, twisting and turning, and you never see them again. And you walk away by yourself under the empty sky, a giant hole ripped in your heart. Or maybe you're working in a grocery store. Maybe you're a boy working in a grocery store, and the owner gives you the key to the store and tells you he wants you to open in the morning. Sam woke at 6 that morning, an hour earlier than he had to. He tiptoed downstairs and he sat at the kitchen table all by himself eating a bowl of Rice Krispies. As he was leaving, his mother came down in her pajamas. "Good luck," she said. He got there 45 minutes before he had to. And he slipped the key in the door and he ran to the alarm and punched in the numbers that Mr. Harmon had written on the small piece of yellow paper. He held his breath until the flashing red light turned to a steady green. And then he exhaled and went about his business. He turned on the lights. He uncovered the vegetables. He fetched the float from under the potatoes in the walk-in cooler. He put out the berries and the fruit. He set the sandwich board on the sidewalk. And then, everything done, he made a coffee on the stove the way Mr. Harmon had taught him, frothing the milk in the stainless steel steamer. Then he opened the door and took the coffee over to the cash register and sat on the stool and waited. He knew the day was going to be crazy until Mr. Harmon got there, but he also knew that he could handle it. It was a lovely feeling, sitting there in the quiet all by himself, knowing that. It was a feeling he'd never had before, like being on a stage before a play, or on a sailboat waiting for the wind. A feeling of being grown up. As it happened, the first customer was a young man that morning, older than Sam, but still young, a college student. He wandered around and then he brought his basket to the counter and stared at his stuff tentatively. "Cooking supper for a girl," he said. Sam looked at the order and then up at the college boy. "It's her birthday," said the boy. Sam nodded. Then he pointed at the box of spaghetti and he said, "May I make a recommendation?" And he walked around from the cash and over to the pasta section and he came back with a brown paper bag of the bow tie farfalle and a little jar of homemade pesto. He said, "I think this will make a bigger impression." Then he said, "One more?" And the college boy nodded. And Sam picked up the iceberg lettuce and came back with a bunch of arugula and a small piece of Parmigiano Reggiano. He said, "Do you have a vegetable peeler?" The college boy nodded. Sam said, "Use it to peel the cheese. Let the pieces of cheese lie on top of the arugula like ribbon. Then drizzle it with some balsamic." The college boy said, "Balsamic?" "From Umbria," said Sam, as he reached for his coffee. He was beaming. If he'd had a thought bubble hanging over his head, and if we could have read it, it would have said, "This is awesome."
Well, that was awesome. It was a good, yummy story. What else? Oh, yes, he ended with a recommendation.
Yeah, which is, I don't know. I love the way that story ends. Mm-hmm. It's very, like, much the end of the, I don't know, the coming of age. Like, you mm-hmm. see him progress throughout this whole story, making a fire recommendation at the end. I'm, like, so hungry right now.
Yeah, that pesto pasta. That's, pesto pasta. What did he do? Arugula with Parmesan.
Drizzle
with balsamic. The balsamic, do not pour it ever.
Do not pour it.
Balsamic from Umbria, which we aren't sure where exactly is on a map, but we implore you, Alchemy listeners, to do your own research.
Yeah.
And form your own opinions about where Umbria is, because it's really up for interpretation. It's not. But he learns how to become an adult. Through food, not fully, but like a little here and there, a little mentorship even.
Well, he's teaching this college kid how to cook. He's showing him up, showing those U of T kids what's boss.
There we go. And like, for how long has he been working at that store? Like, how long was the progression of his little like growth arc?
Oh yeah, no,
do
I
we
don't.
Think?
It probably says, but I forget.
Oh no, guess we have to listen to it
again.
A
couple months. Oh no.
But yeah, no, it's cool because like, he started off as just a little guy. Learns these stories, gets to like travel the world using his mouth and tummy. No passport needed, eating fruit from all across the world, all around the world.
Yeah. No, but this story uses such like great imagery. Like it uses the perfect words. Words that like you would never use in like
Spattered.
Yes, that was the word.
That was it.
Like who says that? But it's also perfect for the story, which is like, and just the dynamics of how Stuart like I don't know, he gets faster at one. There's one part where he starts talking about the bread and he's all excited and it's like an advertising type voice. Like those kinds of dynamics, like, I think are what makes this story my favorite. Like, on top of the imagery, the whole coming of age thing. No, it's a fantastic story and
very good mark.
My favorite.
Very good storytelling.
Yeah. So shout out mom, dad, grandma, and grandpa for putting me and my siblings on this. It's definitely been a big part of our growing up.